real quick content warning, we'll be looking at topics such as gender violence, police brutality, fat phobia, and racial discrimination. Please listen at your discretion.
Bienvenidos all. Happy to be with y'all again. This is Sonia.
This is Gabby.
And this is Sophia.
We are Señora Power. And if your reaction a eso es que, check out the episode 1 to catch up on who we are and what we're up to. This episode is part 2 in our Social Señora series. And listen, we're moving far, far away from the glamorous 1940s Club Chapultepec in our dear Señora Cortés. Because we're in Los Angeles today, specifically El Monte, California, with Gloria Arellanes, an ex-Brown Beret, a woman who was embroiled in the thick of the 1960s Chicano movement. And if Gloria Arellanes has zero fans, then I am dead. I stan Señora Arellanes. I will fight anyone on this. She's a national treasure. All of this information has been sourced from her archive collection at Cal State, which we've all been to together, her interview with Virginia Espino at the Library of Congress, Juan Herrera's book chapter La Lucha Continua in East of East, and the incredible historical and archival work by Dion Espinosa. All right, I want to begin with a simple question. What did y'all know about Señora Arellanes before we began researching her? Follow-up question, was she someone whom we might consider famous within the movement?
Yeah, I think I had heard of Señora Arellanes' name before, or Gloria's name before. She had popped up a lot, especially after I moved to LA. So I think maybe in Texas, I hadn't heard too much about her. But after moving to LA, I heard a lot, especially in Chicano circles, Chicano studies circles. Definitely someone who was well known for speaking out on behalf of Chicanas and Chicana rights, in an activist way, as opposed to another, like, very valid way as well, which is something I've been more familiar with, like writing, you know, art circles, like speaking towards Chicana rights, like artists and writers. Gloria was something kind of more towards activism, using writing, and maybe kind of like bringing together artists, but in a much more like tangible community organizing way, I think.
Yeah, I guess my experience with Señora Arellanes' history is different from Gabby's, especially because, you know, I've been in Texas for most of my life, and I know Gloria Arellanes is a name, as a presence in the movement, or I knew Gloria Arellanes is a presence in the movement, a person who did things differently, a radical person, and so, like, you know, more on the margins than some of the other figures that we know, I think.
Yeah, no, that's perfect. So from your responses, I would say it's safe to conclude that Gloria Arellanes has been cemented in our cultural, or at least Chicano-Chicana imaginary, as the face of activism in organizing efforts. But with this episode, I'm going to make the case that Señora Arellanes, her story is one that bridges the social, as in socializing, work of Señora Cortés to the social, as in social justice work of the movement. Okay, so let's get into it. Señora Arellanes was born in 1946 in East LA, though she has spent most of her life in El Monte, which is just 15 to 20 minutes east of East Los Angeles. Her father was a first-generation Mexican-American, and her mother was a Tongva Native American, the people's original to the LA Basin. Her mother was an important figure in her life for many reasons. First, her mother experienced deeply traumatic discrimination for being Indigenous, and she taught Arellanes how to hide that part of herself, fearing the residential school system that violently assimilated millions of Native Americans across the Americas. At the same time, Arellanes learned from her father that she was a Chicano, which she says in an interview with Espino made her cry and cry. It upset her so much that her identity was not so simply American. You see, Almonte, the city, was an Anglo-dominated municipal for most of her life. It has a place in that larger gold rush story as the end of the Santa Fe Trail or the final location of the route to California, the route of manifest destiny. And twice, actually, in history, white supremacists have immigrated to El Monte from other states to protect its place in this Anglo history. During Arellanes' childhood, the KKK were a very loud, racist community who were angered by the population boom of Mexican Americans who were choosing at the time to stay in El Monte after finding migrant work in the fields. Perhaps both of you might have heard of the El Monte Berry Strike of 1933. It was one of the largest organized labor strikes in Southern California, which I think can also be connected to the concurrent efforts for educational justice. So Mexican Americans in El Monte were fighting at that same time for desegregation for these children. It's a familiar story, isn't it? Both the labor strikes in the field and the education strikes in the schools. So from all of this, we can infer that enduring racism for her, Indigenous and Mexican identities, left a massive impact on her development as a young person, made her bawl at the idea of being a Chicano. But at a very early age, she watched her mother and father fold themselves into El Monte society. Her father was a member of the Elks Club. Have either of you heard of it?
No. Me suena, as in I feel like it's familiar. But I would not be able to tell you if this was about like actual deer or if it was about people. So no.
I would enjoy it much more if it was about actual elk. Instead, it's a fraternal social club, the Benevolent and Protective Order of Elks. And it wasn't officially desegregated until 1973, and women and Black members couldn't join until the 1980s and 1990s. So there's that. But Arellanes' father was a member, and her mother joined the Auxiliary Women's Club. Arellanes says all they did was cook. They made tamales and they hosted get-togethers. But she says they enjoyed each other's company. She remembers it fondly. And it's here that I want to locate a shared joy, maybe not in social clubs specifically, like her mom or Senora Cortez, but the light and nourishment of laughing and being together. Because it is in these socializing spaces that Arellanes actually finds her place in the Chicano movement. So before I go on to her well-known activist work, I'd love to hear any of y'all's thoughts on her backstory so far.
I think it's really powerful that one of the who I consider one of the main figures of the Chicana movement was someone who had to grapple so much with her identity racially. I think that's really significant because I think that actually like that is central to the Chicana identity in the United States. As well as the Mexican identity, I would say, in different ways. But I know that the Chicano movement had this moment of glorifying a kind of vague indigeneity without really confronting or trying to connect with or talking to indigenous people in the current world. And so I think that this is a really important story for Gloria to tell, and I'm sure very harrowing and hard as well, to talk about this trauma that she carried intergenerationally. Her mother, you know, knowing of the residential schools that were actually like meant to do away with Indigenous children, like it was a genocidal project, and we need to name that. And the fact that Gloria Arellanes is this big figure in the Chicana movement is kind of coming out of that is not a coincidence. And I think that this is helpful even for understanding Chicano movement's relationship to indigeneity. Like You know, when the Chicano movement started, it's like, what does it mean to be Chicano, right? Like, a lot of people's answers to that out of necessity were like, well, Chicano is Chicano. And like, indigeneity is folded into that, right? But now we can have a larger conversation about what it means to bring an indigenous identity into a Chicano community, right? Like, so anyway, I appreciate that. And I think that the social circle part of it is really important for proving like indigenous survival, like for proving like Chicano survival, which is actually survival in these communities, is transgressive when you're dealing with a white supremacist system that wants to do away with you or reduce you to like only labor, right? So I think that this is both uplifting and also important to talk about like the trauma behind these kinds of things.
Yeah. And just to like sort of go off of on what Gabby said, right, about how Arellanes helps us realize the erasure of indigeneity within these Chicano circles. But she also, like, her backstory also makes us remember about the gendered erasures as well in these same kind of circles, right? Like, there had to be, as with Señora Cortés, there had to be like an auxiliary club for women where they could do like womanly stuff, right? And cook and engage in chisme and like have moments of joy, which to a certain extent, I mean, to be able to make time and space for those moments of joy within like your activism, within your trauma, within your lived reality, that can also be a pretty radicalizing thing and feeling and action too.
Totally. All really great points. And it leads really well into what she ends up doing with sort of the middle part of her life, because her first job was at Teen Post, which was established in part by Señora Lupe Anguiano. So Arellanes helped as a young person upkeep this after-school social programming for Mexican-American youth. And then after high school, she tried to go to East LA College. She hated it, dropped out. But her social life was thriving. She had all these amigas who would go cruising down Whittier Boulevard. And it was there that she started to go to La Piraña, which was a coffee house where young activists would meet to hang out and make plans for their civil rights oriented organizations. It's at La Piraña that Arellanes meets David Sanchez, a young man who would become one of the faces of the Chicano movement. He asks her at that time to join Young Citizens for Community Action, which would later become the Brown Berets. And at first she's like, I'm just cruising, like, you know. Which, side note, her and David end up having a very long, very intense relationship that I've understood to be frenemies. But eventually she joins and becomes one of the few Chicana Brown Berets. Okay, for those who don't know, could one of y'all please define the Brown Berets for us?
The Brown Berets were a militant organization formed out of California. They were a section of the Chicano movement. Not all of the Chicano nationalists agreed with them. They mostly engaged in protests and marches, mostly against the Vietnam War, right? They would engage in all these marches and protests, and their one distinguishing sort of like symbol was the Brown Beret that they would all wear. They would wear these very military looking uniforms precisely because they were a militant group and very active out in the streets.
Yes, excellent. The Brown Berets were exactly, as you said, a paramilitary civil rights organization named after the uniform, which included berets that were brown. Exactly. Very in the fashion and genuinely actually inspired by the Black Panthers. Señora Arellanes learned so much in her time with the Brown Berets, including what I would call the roots of intersectionality. In 1968, so she's like 22, technically not a señora, you know, she doesn't have a husband, sin esposo, no kids. But she travels to Washington, D.C. to join the Poor People's Campaign, a collective demand and march organized by Martin Luther King Jr. The Poor People's Campaign demanded economic justice, like increased low-income housing and better funding and resources to increase employment rate. And it's at this event that she meets Black people, poor white people, indigenous women in full tribal wear. She says her jaw was on the floor. and she was able to spend time and socialize with a diverse group of activists who didn't know what Chicano was. She kept being asked, "What is a Chicano?" And she would have to explain herself. So there's like a real moment of self-definition here for her as well. And at the same time, she begins to realize that police brutalized and targeted not just Chicanos or Black people, which was the central focus in LA, but during the Poor People's Campaign protests, police were pulling women, children, men indiscriminately from the picket line and beating them with batons. It was a moment of intense conflict and extraordinary socialization for Arellanes. And soon after this event, Arellanes begins her journey with El Barrio Free Clinic. And it starts with David Sanchez declaring that there will be a free clinic in East LA and then demanding that it's Arellanes who will run it. And at first, again, she's like, what? ¿Qué? ¿Por qué me? No, she's not into it. But he's like, you're going to do it. And so she does. But then it becomes a passion project for her. El Barrio Free Clinic is established on Whittier Boulevard and becomes a massive success under Arellanes' administration. They offered free sex education, STD testing, pregnancy testing, various forms of birth control, IUDs, the pill, diaphragms. They held free immunization drives and physical examinations for children, all free. And all this time, Arellanes is at the helm, on location every single night with clinicians, psychologists, doctors who would volunteer their time after work, staying until 9, 10 p.m. at night. When asked how she handled this responsibility, why she was given this job when other Chicanas we know were never given anything but cooking and cleaning work for the Brown Berets, Arellanes confidently says, "I was loudmouthed, big boned." She says she weighed about 300 pounds at the time and was considered a very, very tall for a woman. And for most of her life, she'd been bullied so much for her weight that she says, quote, "The harassment and the way people treated me made me a fighter. And you just reach a point where I reached a point where I said, if people want to look at all this fat on me and this big body and judge me for that, then I have no use for them. They need to look at what's here in my heart. Once I did that, I wasn't so shy. I came out of my shyness and didn't mind being in a leadership position and had no problem speaking out. That goes back to being the big, scary woman that scared people. When I talked, they would listen to me." And people did. Huge movement leaders from David Sanchez to Carlos Montes have said, "When Gloria spoke, you listened." And though Arellanes often felt like a glorified secretary for the Brown Berets, she was an outspoken one. And she was outspoken, and I want to emphasize here, she was joyful. Amidst the chaos of the El Barrio Free Clinic, Arellanes would host parties for the doctors and volunteers where she remembers laughing and being joyful, feeding people tamales for the first time for some of them, hosting fundraisers, bailes, and even a zoot suit themed party. So I want to stop here and ask, what do we think about this joy in socializing within community building, about Arellanes' leadership as a Chicana Brown Beret?
Yeah, I think it's remarkable, really, because I see here, especially in the life details that you've chosen for us, Sonia, that like Gloria had to work within a certain structure that defined her as a woman in certain ways, right? Like hemmed in by gender roles, like, right? Like you will do what men say that you need to do, right? You will start this free clinic, like you will do this, but you're also going to listen to the men when they tell you what to do. And I know, like, because of what she did with the free clinic, she took the initiative and was an administrator. She was a great administrator. Her work was not recognized necessarily by the men in that movement at the time. She says that, which is why, you know, she later, you know, declares like, "Hey, like none of us Chicanas are being appreciated by," but she took on that role and she made it her own. And I think the social part of it was like bringing people together. Like she herself says, like at first people were like, "What is this free clinic? I don't trust it." So in order to get people to come to the resources that the Brown Berets were trying to provide for the community, you have to have a social aspect. Like, you have to say, you can trust us, or I'm your neighbor, or I'm just a regular person, right? And in order to get that to that level, you have to engage in the social aspect of it, especially if you're a woman. I think that engaging in this part of like organizing events, right? Like, or like making a meal and like inviting people to it, selling tamales. This was something people were very familiar with. A lot of our señoras, as we've said before, sold tamales very well. And I think that that's actually like, you know, that's community organizing, actually. Like, a lot of community organizing is like, oh, hey, like, I heard that you need some help, right? Like, I heard that you were laid off, or like, I heard that you hurt your leg or whatever, right? Like, let me put you in contact with someone who can help you out. Or in Gloria's case, like, let me bring you over to the clinic. Like, let me go to your house. Let me evaluate what you need, right? And I think that none of that's possible without the social aspect of it. I think a lot of times activism is shown to be this like big, like, war-like thing, where you stand up on stages and you give really important speeches and you get arrested and you go out on the street and like you fight against police. And sometimes it is that, and that's like really important, but often it's like, let me go and knock on people's house door, right? Like, let me like hang out where the community members are hanging out and talk to them and get to know what their problems are and empower them to help themselves. And I think that that's what Gloria was doing with her social aspect of like being present in the community, like being a part of the community, and truly figuring out what they needed, which is why something like a free clinic that she was organizing fell apart when she left. And she was like, okay, have fun without me. I'm going to go do my own thing over here and still help the community, and everyone's going to come to me, which was true. That did happen. So I find that the social aspect for me, in summary, is part of Gloria being the best community organizer that she could be, is being part of the community, is listening to the community.
And I guess just to pick up on another detail of Gloria's life that Sonia has brought to us, I feel like community work often starts with the individual, right? In a sense that once Gloria decided to not be shy about her body, once Gloria decided to like ignore the people who are judging her for like looking a particular way, that also is an impulse towards being an active participant in your community. If you don't have those kinds of like negativity imposed on you, to be able to sort of do away with that and turn it into like a smaller thing that does not sort of define oneself, but does shape oneself, right?
Well, and also I think that she not only like went around it or like avoided it or like overcame it or whatever, but she used it to like, she used the kind of like prejudice, like the kind of fat phobia that we see today, right? Like, fat phobia is one of the types of like very violent discrimination and like violence that is still very acceptable to say and like openly have like that kind of prejudice towards people out in the open in public, right? And I think that she took that and she made it something that helped her gain access to what she wanted. So like, she says herself, right, that like no one was gonna mess with her. Like, she said, like, you know, if you're gonna see me as maybe like less of a woman, or if you're gonna treat me as like less of a person because of how I look, then I'm gonna get what I want. And you know, people, she said, like, people were scared of her. And I would say, like, you know, part of that is this like objectification of like women's bodies, that when they are over a certain weight, like they become, it becomes a different kind of objectification where you're like, oh, like be out of my sight, or you don't deserve certain rights, you didn't deserve like certain care, certain love, certain affection. That's very violent. It's very sexist and fatphobic. And I think that she said, like, you know what, fine, like, but I am going to make the kind of space that I want to be in, and I'm going to use your prejudices in order to make a world where I'm doing what I want. And she did that, right? Like, no one wanted to mess with her. But I would argue that it's also because no one wanted to mess with her because she, like, said, here's my boundary. Like, she placed a boundary and she said, like, I'm going to back my words up with my actions. And she, you know, made sure that she was very, like, essential in this community because people, like, knew that she would listen to them because they knew that she would solve their problems, right? So I think this is an interesting intersection of, like, sexism and fat phobia, that Gloria actually managed to make, to use to make a space for herself.
Yeah, 100%. I agree with all of that. And it's reminding me of something I haven't included yet, but she often called herself a mama bear. And I think because, like, the men weren't willing to mess with her, she would often protect women who were victims of sexual assault. And so they would go to Gloria and they would tell her about it. And she would go up to the men and she would yell at them and she would yell at David Sanchez. And she would be like, you need to control them, which actually brings us to our final section, because I have to cover her exit, as you brought up, Gabby from the Brown Berets and her creation of Las Adelitas de Aslan. Going back to El Barrio Clinic, Mel Brown Berets did not participate almost at all in the daily functions of this clinic. She did all of this work with the volunteers that she had and the Chicanas who helped. But Arianes recalls that the male Brown Berets started using the clinic for after-hours parties. She would come back and find beer bottles hanging around examination rooms. She would find men hanging around when children were getting checked out in their military garb. And in one incident, she remembers a man getting into a fight with another male group who had a gun. And so he fled to the clinic as a hideout. And she was furious. She demanded David Sanchez control the male Brown Berets, threatening to leave her role as she was then Minister of Finance and Correspondence and as director of the free clinic. And she threatened to take all the women with her, which is exactly what happens. To quote directly from the resignation letter, she writes, all Brown Beret women have also resigned from further duties in this organization. We have been treated as nothings and not as revolutionary sisters. We have found that the Brown Beret men have oppressed us more than the pig system has. And it was after this resignation that Arianes created Las Adelitas de Aslan, which we can call the burgeoning of Chicana feminism, a collective of Chicanas who came together to create their own boundaries, to fight for themselves, and to gather resources for their community. And it's with this collection of women that she joins the Chicano Moratorium of 1970, 1971, or the anti-Vietnam protests, and the largest series of gatherings of Chicanos of that time. Obviously, the male Brown Berets were not happy about Las Adelitas being there, but Arellanes recalls this time as a breath of fresh air, both the moratorium and working with Rosario Munoz, an important organizer of this anti-war protest. She says he was amazing to work with, really wonderful, laughing all the time, and just super supportive of Chicana's involvement. She remembers feeling a feeling of celebration, of beautiful air of dancers, singers, and festiveness, a feeling which unfortunately was interrupted once again by police violence. Arianes recalls being tear gassed while she was on stage, and it was in this violent moment that Ruben Salazar, a huge Chicano activist at the time, was killed by LAPD. Unfortunately, Las Adelitas dissolves very soon after this. But the impact has reverberated far beyond the organization. I think Arianes herself has left an impact that goes beyond the actual time that she spent as an activist, beyond her work with the Brown Berets and at the clinic, but a clear source of community resource gathering, of creating spaces for Chicanas to socialize, for people who care about the community to come together and be joyous and laugh together. Afterwards, she goes on to work for El Monte City for about 20 years, and about 16 to 18 of those years were at the Sheriff's Department. She says this was really difficult work because she still felt a lot of resentment, anger, fear towards policemen, even reminding them quite regularly that she participated in the Chicana blowouts, which they would laugh at and say, yes, we know. And then she would remind them, I probably stood on the opposite side of that picket line and called you a pig. And they were like, yeah, we know. But overall, she found that she really liked working on the administrative side of policing. She recalls saying that people were not rampantly racist, but genuinely good and kind. And she would go on to develop training programs for officers, such as diversity training, anti-racial profiling. And she says that many ex-Brown Beret women actually went into some form of administration for law enforcement. So I wanted to include that because I think we're also interested in the afterlives of our activists when they actually are señoras and they actually are sort of doing work with the establishment, which creates a lot of questions for us, a lot of interesting moments. But any final thoughts on Señora Arias, our second social señora?
I think it's interesting. I think this is kind of, we've been talking about this a lot amongst ourselves, the idea that actually a good amount of our señoras who were activists or who had very strong feelings about like the racial discrimination their community faced became part of their local police stations or like local sheriff stations. Like they either became consultants for them or administrators, like Gloria was saying in LA, that happened as well. And I think it's worth talking about because seeing the pervasive violence and racism that is the reality with a lot of police, with police like in general, the police violence towards like racialized bodies like cannot be excused. It's also something that has been shown to be part of training of police forces. So I think it's interesting that Gloria was looking to intervene in that training to try to stop the violence where she saw it as a source. Whether or not that's effective, I think, is another conversation. It's just such a large scale thing, right? Like policing. And I think that having the conversation about what policing, like the purpose of it is pretty important to understanding whether or not your interventions as an activist inside of policing is going to be effective or not. But I think that a lot of these señoras ending up inside of the policing system, it's definitely, I think, on an individual level, I see it as like, okay, I'm desperate for the violence to stop in my communities. Like, how can I help with that? And I honor that impulse.
Yes, I think it's so true. And she said before, like, I didn't think Las Adelitas was much because it only lasted a few months, you know? And then, like, she recalls in I think an LA Times article that she got interviewed for, like, women still come up to me and say, oh my god, Las Adelitas was incredible, like, I still think about it. And she's like, I can't, like, she can't believe it, you know, sometimes, like, the impact that it had beyond the time that it actually was around. But it's so important that I think this bridging work between, like, Señora Cortez and her mom who were in these auxiliary social clubs, these collective spaces of women that they were forced into as the wives of club members, and then the bridge to these collective spaces of women like Las Adelitas, like the Chicanas who were doing this work, is just so incredible, I think. And it's a really tangible sort of pattern within Chicana political consciousness creating. And I think the other thing that's really interesting too, two notes while y'all are talking, when she joined the sheriff's department, it's because a friend told her to. A friend said, hey, you should do this. I'm doing it, you should do it too. So I think there's a way too that, like, when you have a friend, a woman who signals to you, this is a place that is safe, this is a place that you might be successful, that you might find something here, something, you know, that you find valuable, then that I think opens a lot as well. And then two, she only later realized in her life that, like, that collective power of gathering women who were considered powerless is the emergence of Chicana feminism as we know it today. She didn't consider herself a feminist for most of her life. She is such a great example, I think, of what Chicana feminists came to be. Like, what we know now is what she began to do. So I love her so much. I'm a stan. And I just want to say this is one example of Senora power. I'm excited to dive into the third part of our series on social senoras to discuss between the three of us about some of the similarities and differences between the community building of Senora Cortez and Senora Arellanes. So stick around for that.